until Israelis and Palestinians come to terms with each other as human beings with full rights, it's going to be very hard to move into a peace mode.
They do not want that total vision to be seen and embraced because it can be used as a galvanizing force for women and men and families that are oppressed all over the world.
I feel as though as long as Bush is in office, I'm not going to survive in the military. And I want to survive as long as I can because he wants a war. And we're going to have another war eventually.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, June 19th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A rocket-propelled grenade slammed into a U.S. military ambulance today, killing one American soldier and wounding two others. It was the latest in a series of attacks on U.S. personnel or their offices. The ambulance was transporting a wounded American soldier to a medical facility when it came under fire on a highway about 20 miles south of Baghdad. The casualties were members of the 804th Medical Brigade, and their identities were being withheld pending notification of relatives. Meanwhile, scores of angry Iraqi mourners fired Kalashnikov assault rifles into the air and shouted curses at the United States during a funeral procession today for two Iraqis who were shot dead by U.S. troops at a protest by disgruntled former Army officers, shouting death to Bush and revenge. Mourners marched with the body of 32-year-old former Iraqi Army officer Tariq Hussein Mohammed, killed by U.S. troops from his house in northern Baghdad to a mosque. Mohammed was one of two men shot outside the gate of the coalition headquarters in Baghdad during a demonstration of ex-soldiers demanding their salaries. The men were shot after the protest turned violent, the U.S. military said. About 1,000 Israeli troops and police scuffled with hundreds of angry Jewish settlers on a West Bank hilltop today as the military tried to tear down a tiny tent camp, the first populated outpost targeted under the U.S.-backed roadmap peace plan. But violence continued. A Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up in an Israeli grocery store, killing the owner, despite an intense push by Palestinian and international leaders to persuade militant groups to end attacks. Ram Rahat Goodman is a member of Yesh Gaval, the original Israeli refusenik movement. He told Peace Watch today, "The outposts have to go." He says they pose an obstacle to any kind of peaceful solution and represent power grabs on the part of the settlers to displace the Palestinians.
The fact that they're there at all is something that the Israeli government for many years have either turned a blind eye to or actually encouraged. Sharon himself was the man that said in 1996 that they should go out and capture all the hilltops. As to the process of dismantling, I still think the army isn't taking it very seriously in terms of what they could be doing. They're still treating them in a lot of ways with kids' gloves and waffling in terms of what they could be doing.
Mm-hmm.
What's a very standard practice for dealing with the demonstration of Palestinians or even leftists, Israeli leftists, using tear gas, for instance, has never been employed on the outposts.
Now, the outposts consisted of only about 10 people living in tents, but still some are characterizing it as a symbolic beginning to what is likely to be a long and difficult process. Can you describe for us the sort of peculiar predicament that now exists where the Israeli Defense Forces, who have traditionally protected and defended Jewish settlements in the West Bank, are now being asked to dismantle them?
Yes, the army has generally been used to taking part in the process of expanding the settlements and helping the settlers along in the land grabs. And I still think that the army's basic intention is to continue carrying out that policy. I think in a lot of ways, what we're dealing with the outpost is a cosmetic action. In other words, we're taking apart small, insignificant outposts the largest of which are what you described of, as a couple of tents, maybe a mobile home with about 10 people. Many of them even aren't inhabited at all, and are being many of them what are being taken apart now are completely uninhabited. And in a certain way, that takes off the pressure, or it distracts from the basic fact of the settlements, which all still exist, that no one's making any attempt to take apart, and many of the satellite outposts that have been legalized in terms of the Israeli legal system around the existing settlements.
Mm. And so, how many settlements would you say there are totally? I'm seeing figures of as many as more than 100 set up since 1996 alone.
You're talking about the outposts now, not the settlements.
Okay, the outpost.
Yeah, there are more than 100, and there are more than 100 outposts. There are also 200 to 300 settlements in the occupied territories today.
And so we hear a term used, unauthorized settlements. Are there authorized settlements?
There are authorized settlements in terms of the Israeli legal system, or in terms of the rather complex legal system that's been set up in the territories, in the occupied territories by Israel. And since it's not, there's one law for Palestinians and another law for the Jewish settlers in the occupied territories. So in terms of Israeli law, in terms of possibly in terms of the military, many of the settlements and some and a good portion of the outposts have received permits for building. Obviously, under international law, there's no such thing as a legal settlement.
Mm-hmm.
This is only in terms of Israeli law, because the Geneva Convention claims that states that you cannot transfer your own population into occupied territories.
Ram, how much criticism is the dismantling of the settlements drawing from both Jewish settlers and critics within Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's own Likud party?
The settlers are obviously very vehemently opposed to it, because they've always taken a maximalist position. In other words, they will struggle for any small minor point. Some of these are tactical struggles, because they're saying, okay, if we struggle for everything, if we make everything into something critical, then they'll win on the less, let's say, the less extreme points. In other words, by making a large fight for this small, tiny outpost, they make it seem less less extreme, the maintenance of the larger settlements. That can probably be said also of part of Sharon's government, not all of it. The majority of the government did give its agreement to the dismantling of the outposts.
Hmm. I know Sharon faced a great bit of criticism, harsh criticism, from several members of the Likud several weeks ago when he voiced support for the latest Middle East peace effort. He said, quote, "ruling 3.5 million Palestinians can't go on indefinitely," in unquote. Have you sensed that that's the general sentiment among many Israelis, that the fighting has gone on too long and some sort of resolution has to be reached soon?
Oh, it's a very complex question. Yes and no. I mean, it's not a black and white thing. I think most Israelis would like, certainly want the fighting to stop, certainly want to not be controlling the majority of the Palestinians, but they're not willing to reconcile with the idea of giving up large areas of the settlements are in order to facilitate that. This certainly can be said of Sharon. Sharon's vision is the same vision that he's had for 30 years. It's just changed names. He's talking about the small cantonments of Palestinians who will not have a full nation and the full state in the real sense of the word. With Israel controlling a maximum amount of territory with a minimum amount of Palestinians.
Ram Rahat Goodman is a member of Yesh Gaval, the original Israeli Refusenik movement. Secretary of State Colin Powell said he plans to travel to Israel and the Palestinian territories tomorrow in hope of restoring momentum to the U.S.-led efforts to bring peace to the region. Guidelines issued this week by the U.S. Department of Justice call for the banning of racial and ethnic profiling, except in cases involving national security or border issues. The ban will affect over 70 federal agencies and about 120,000 U.S. law enforcement officers, including those from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. But critics of the ban say the Justice Department guidelines actually give the government a green light to profile Arab and South Asian immigrants. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, Jackson Allers reports on how this national policy will actually be implemented.
It was President George W. Bush's directive in February of 2001 that prompted the Justice Department and Attorney General John Ashcroft to come up with the ban on racial and ethnic profiling. The Justice Department refused to comment on the report, but did refer to a press release stating law enforcement officials could no longer engage in racial profiling, quote, even where profiling would otherwise be permitted by the Constitution and existing laws. Stephen Watt at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City has been dealing firsthand with what he says are racially motivated abuses in the wake of the September 11 attacks. Watt is representing 7 former immigrant detainees in a class action lawsuit for alleged abuses at the hands of INS officers and federal prison officials. He says a ban is only the first step when considering the actions of some 120,000 law enforcement officers.
In relation to the detentions post 9/11, there was policy in place there that essentially sanctioned racial profiling. But you had a problem there in that there was policies handed down and that had to be implemented by persons on the ground. And in any ban in place on racial profiling, there has to be careful follow-up on that to ensure that the persons on the ground that are actually implementing these policies are actually enforcing them in practice.
The Justice Department policy establishes 2 sets of guidelines. The first applies to routine law enforcement decisions, such as traffic stops, where race or ethnicity has been a deciding factor in who gets stopped. In these cases, the policy states federal agents, quote, may not use race or ethnicity to any degree, except that officers may rely on race and ethnicity in a specific suspect description. But it is the second set of weaker standards for issues relating to national security and border integrity that is causing critics of the policy to take note. According to the Justice Department, racial or ethnic profiles can be considered if intelligence officials indicate that a certain ethnic group planned to commit a terrorist act. Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
It seems that they've created rhetoric with an exception big enough you could drive a Mack truck through it. And we know it's empty rhetoric because of their massive discriminatory attacks on the Arab and South Asian communities.
In a report released by the Department of Justice earlier this month, the Attorney General's office and the FBI were accused of violating the civil rights of hundreds of immigrants detained after 9/11. Among the violations documented in the 198-page report was the, quote, pattern of physical and verbal abuse at a federal prison where 84 prisoners, mostly of Arab and South Asian descent, were held. Meanwhile, Lieberman of the New York Civil Liberties Union says the weaker racial profiling guidelines for national security or border issues is a formula for disaster.
It overwhelms law enforcement agencies with lots of information that they don't need about people about whom they have no suspicion. It leads to following false leads because the leads are based on skin color rather than suspicious activities. Meanwhile, it prompts law enforcement to fail to follow other leads because they're busy following stereotypes.
Accordingly, Adam Carroll, 911 relief coordinator for the New York-based Islamic Circle of North America, says the Justice Department guidelines are hardly enforceable.
You know, someone like Nabil Ayesh, who was pulled over at a traffic light in Pennsylvania last year, and because he had Allah is great bumper sticker, and then when it turned out he was Palestinian, they ran him through the computer and decided to take him in. I mean, that could happen again. I think that police, if they wish to cover themselves could easily claim to be following some kind of all-points bulletin. I mean, it really is not much of a tool to safeguard civil liberties at all.
The guidelines cover only federal agencies, not state and local police agencies. Ralph Boyd, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the Justice Department, has said he hopes state and local officials will use the federal policies as a model where policies do not exist. But law enforcement agencies throughout the country have already enacted bans on racial profiling, including the New York Police Department, that released a report this week confirming that African Americans accounted for at least half of the department's stop and frisks in a six-month period of 2002, while African Americans make up only 25% of the city's population. Meanwhile, the new ban on racial and ethnic profiling will not deter the Department of Citizenship and Immigration Services from registering those immigrants of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Jackson Allers for Peace Watch.
It's believed that more than 3,000 Arab Americans are currently in custody, with countless more being deported and barred for life from reentry into the U.S. Haroon Siddiqui, an Arab Canadian and the editorial page editor emeritus at the Toronto Star newspaper, recently wrote a commentary entitled Ayatollah Ashcroft's Law, How the U.S. Attorney General, a Christian evangelist with anti-Islamic views on record, is waging war on American Muslims. Peace Watch spoke with him earlier today.
In the days following 9/11, George W. Bush provided exemplary leadership. He was calm, yet resolute. He was patient when most people wanted him to go hit someone, anyone. Unfortunately, the government's actions over the past 20 months are in sharp contrast to its words, says the American Civil Liberties Association, rightly so, because the war on terror has turned into a war on immigrants. Out in Iraq, President Bush has promised to bring democracy to Iraqis. So while these American ideals are being preached abroad, they are being breached at home. A report by the Justice Department's own internal watchdog has given us an account of what happened to the 662 illegal aliens detained after September 11. The men were jailed an average of 80 days, some up to 8 months. Some had been picked up on totally unsubstantiated tips. A salesman with a wife and 5 children, for example, all lawful permanent residents, was arrested because he had a map on which he had circled some cities that he was going to call. 3 men were grabbed at a New York traffic light because they had building plans for a school that they were working on. Their boss verified the fact that they were indeed construction workers, yet they were not released. Some of the detainees were taunted and bullied. They were denied their weekly phone call. They were lied to, as were families and lawyers inquiring about them. How many of these 762 were charged with terrorism? Not one. In fact, the total number of people jailed is not just 762. The total is thought to be about 3,000. Take the case of registering all Muslim men. This program targets non-citizens and non-green card holders from 25 nations. This was a general cattle call with no individual notification. But if you happen to be one of the hundreds and thousands of people who are in the United States legally on student, business, or visitor visa, and you did not comply, you could become a permanently inadmissible person. About 83,000 people responded, including many illegals hoping to win leniency, but they didn't. About 13,000 have now been marked for deportation. Rather than risk arrest, thousands of other people fled the United States. These people were not terrorists, as the Civil Liberties Association says. They came to the United States for the same reason generations of other people have come to America: for economic betterment and for freedom and liberty. How many terrorists have been unearthed under this program? Not one that we know of. Take the next government initiative, which is called Operation Tarmac. This was a security sweep of sensitive workplaces, including the airports, a justifiable measure. But it has since been extended to private firms supplying goods and services to airports and airlines. People who have never set foot near an airport were dragged in. Again, question is, how many terrorists were found in these mass arrests? Not one. Take the government initiative called volunteer interviews, which are not very voluntary. These have been highly coercive encounters for about 8,000 people who were identified by the FBI for questioning. They were questioned about their religion, and about their political views in violation of their constitutional right to freedom of speech and religion. Take yet another government initiative, the mandatory detention of all asylum seekers. This program started before the war in Iraq, and it was designed to protect America from terrorists. Again, this was a reasonable proposition, but the program has since morphed into a new one. Anyone arriving from Haiti, and not necessarily just from there, is being jailed. This is a contravention of international forms. Late last week, the government announced new guidelines on dealing with detainees. President Bush has announced new guidelines on racial and ethnic profiling. While welcome, neither will guarantee the end of abuses that we have seen in the last 18 months. The government must fight terrorism, no question, but none of these measures has made America safer. Instead of targeting terrorists, the government is targeting immigrants. It is making the pile so big that it will be that much more difficult to find a terrorist in this huge haystack. As the Civil Liberties Union says, selective law enforcement, religious, ethnic, and racial profiling, holding people incommunicado, and conducting closed hearings should never happen in the United States. All these measures violate America's democratic traditions. They harm the credibility of America abroad. More important, they harm America.
Haroon Siddiqui is an Arab Canadian and the editorial page editor emeritus at the Toronto Star. Well, as the oil resumes its flow out of Iraq this weekend and new reports of U.S. fatalities are seen each day, the question of Iraqi resistance remains an issue that official U.S. sources have been quick to sweep under the rug. Outside of Iraq, the global resistance to the war was a moment in history that stretched across borders of geography and class, a moment which Pakistani exile and political commentator Tariq Ali believes has irrevocably jeopardized American hegemony in the region. Today, in this third installment of a three-part series we've been airing here on Peace Watch, we present an analysis by Ali on the nature of worldwide resistance to the U.S.-style empire.
So how are they going to rule Iraq? That's the question. All these quislings who were telling Bush that the American troops would be welcomed with flowers and sweets when they arrived, they've been proved to be totally wrong. In fact, there was no welcome for the foreign troops. In reality, all the serious journalists who were there, including some of the more serious embedded journalists, reported that they were surprised at the degree of hostility to the occupation from ordinary Iraqis. Now, I ask myself, why were they surprised? I mean, this is a country which has a long tradition of resistance. And so very similar things happened this time when the U.S. troops went in. They said, we're glad to get rid of Saddam, but now get out. We don't want you here. We're quite capable of running this country ourselves. And this is where the problem arises. This is where the liberal jokers who supported the war on the grounds that somehow it would bring modernization and democracy to Iraq are going to, you know, be proved to be completely wrong. Because the first thing you do, if you have democracy in Iraq, given what's been going on in that country, you will probably have a religious party of Shiites in a majority for a short time, but they will be. Then what? But let's say they don't even go for that, but they just decide and vote for Iraqi oil remaining in Iraqi hands and saying, we don't want your multinationals in here. What then? Another regime change? This time of a democratically elected government? So they won't let it reach that stage. So given that, this is what is going to be used. They are not yet ready for democracy. A traditional colonial explanation from denying people the right to self-determination for time immemorial. The people are not yet ready. We from a superior civilization determine when they are ready. Whether the Iraqis will wait for that time is an open question. The information that is coming out of Iraq is very interesting. There is a political resistance taking place. And there is great anger in that world that Iraq was allowed to be captured with all the Arab leaders standing by and watching. In fact, waving fond farewells to the occupying troops as they passed without the need to pay a fee through the Suez Canal. That's what it had come to. And these people will pay a price, whether it's over the next 5 years or 10 years, it will happen. So for resistance, serious resistance, which could affect the empire, one has to look in the countries which are occupied. And incidentally, one doesn't hear that much about Afghanistan, but do not underestimate the instability in that country, that despite over a year of occupation now, they have not been able to stabilize the situation. The puppet regime imposed on Afghanistan is incapable of exercising its writ in Kabul, leave alone the rest of the country. And people are waiting. They're waiting for the troops to be withdrawn so they can make a rush for the country again. Because there's no alternative strategy, no alternative social formation which is envisaged to put in place in that country. And the other question is that we are now living in a different period where the Washington consensus is twofold. The Washington consensus has imposed a neoliberal vision on the whole world. And the notion that this vision, I mean, it's not working in Latin America, where it was first put into place. The whole of the Latin American continent in some shape or form is in revolt against this imperial economic vision of neoliberal economics. It's a failure. It's failed. You have governments being elected with the people wanting the governments to challenge it. So it's these forms of resistance which are of interest to us, much more than resistance by actual states. Because it's when the people resist, when there's a resistance from below, that it really counts for something. And I'll tell you something. If Baghdad had decided, it's very interesting what happened in Iraq. You know, the people say American power is irresistible. Well, it's true, but it's not true at the same time. It's only irresistible if you decide not to resist it. That's the thing. And I have to be honest with you. When there was resistance for the first 2 or 3 weeks when the occupation armies went in, I was very happy. I really was, that there was some resistance by people in these cities and the Fedayeen. Because it would have been awful if they'd been trampled over just like that. And it's very noticeable a wave of pride which swept the entire Arab world, that someone's resisted. And they knew it wouldn't last long. Because the big aim of the empire is to change regimes without, you know, antagonizing the population too much. They did it in Kosovo and Afghanistan, but that was different. And I think we might even see an ironical situation developing, where in order to police an unruly population which is getting fed up with the occupation, they might bring back a number of the old Ba'athist people in order to police the population. It's happened before, because empires, whether it's old ones or new ones or the only ones, do not like to face an angry populace. They need people to control it. They prefer if they can find allies to do it. So that's the resistance which one waits for. And tied to that resistance, of course, is what happens inside the United States of America. Now, one of the most heartening things which was noticed globally and was noticed in the Arab world and the world beyond in the Far East was the size and scale of the mobilizations in the United States, which are unprecedented because these took place to prevent a war from taking place. And then once the war had begun, the mobilization of 500,000 in New York, a city which has become symbolic after 9/11, had a very big impact. And the demonstrations on the West Coast, here in San Francisco, when once the war began, and the city was virtually brought to a halt, also had a very big impact, that there was another America. And this is what I say when I travel to the Arab world, that there are two Americas. There is an empire and those who support it. There is a passive population which will not oppose it unless it's won over. And there is an active but growing minority which is opposed to these imperial adventures and which is opposed to the empire. And that this this is a minority which is to be helped and supported and solidarized with, because it's a very important minority, because without this minority, we are doomed.
Tariq Ali is a Pakistani exile and political commentator. Special thanks to Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio for production assistance with that piece. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.